Chapter 81. The Gambler. To avoid the threat of submarine and aerial attack in the Mediterranean, Randolph Churchill's ship, the Glenroy, took the long way to Egypt, down the west coast of Africa, and then back up to the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, and the Suez Canal. The voyage was long and tedious, 36 days to reach the entrance to the canal on March 8th. Finding little else in the way of distraction, Randolph turned to one of his favourite pursuits. There was very high gambling, poker, roulette, chemin de fer, every night, Evelyn Waugh wrote in a memorandum about the commando unit. Randolph lost £850 in 2 evenings. In a letter to his own wife, Waugh remarked, "Poor Pamela will have to go to work." As the voyage progressed, Randolph's losses deepened until he owed his fellow voyagers £3,000, $12,000. Equivalent to over $190,000 today. Half of that was owed to just one man, Peter Fitzwilliam, a member of one of the richest families in England, soon to inherit Wentworth Woodhouse, a vast mansion in Yorkshire, thought by some to be the inspiration for Jane Austen's Pemberley in Pride and Prejudice. Randolph broke the news to Pamela in a telegram, in which he instructed her to pay off the debt in any way she could. He suggested she send each man £5 or £10 a month. Anyway, he concluded, "I leave it up to you, but please don't tell my mother and father." Pamela, certain now that she was indeed again pregnant, was stunned and frightened. This was the breaking point, she said. At £10 a month, she would have needed a dozen years just to resolve the debt to Fitzwilliam. The amount was unfathomable, so much so that it brought into focus how fundamentally defective her marriage was. I mean, that was the first realization in my life that I was totally on my own, and that the future of my son was dependent entirely on me, and my future was dependent on me, that I couldn't rely ever again on Randolph, she said. She recalled thinking, "What the hell do I do? I can't go to Clemmy and Winston." Almost immediately, Beaverbrook came to mind. "I liked him enormously, admired him tremendously," she said. She considered him a close friend, and, along with baby Winston, had spent a number of weekends at his country home, Charkley. He felt the same way, although those who knew Beaverbrook understood that he saw a value in their connection that went beyond mere friendship. She was a conduit of gossip from within the loftiest circle in the land. She called Beaverbrook and sobbed into the phone. "Max, can I come see you?" She got into her Jaguar and drove to London. It was morning, the risk of being bombed, therefore, slight. She drove through streets made drab by destruction and dust, but coloured here and there by flashes of wallpaper, paint, and fabric from the exposed interiors of houses. She met Beaverbrook at the new offices of the Ministry of Aircraft Production, now situated in a large oil company building on the Thames embankment. She told him about the gambling debt and about her marriage, warning that he was not to divulge any of it to Clementine or to Churchill, whom she knew to be Beaverbrook's closest friend. Of course, he assented. Secrets were his favourite possessions. She asked him right off whether he would consider giving her a year's advance on Randolph's salary. It seemed to her an easy request, one that Beaverbrook would surely fulfil. After all, Randolph's job with the Evening Standard was more sinecure than anything else. With the immediate crisis averted, she could get on with the larger question of how, or even whether, to proceed with her marriage. Beaverbrook looked at her. "I won't advance Randolph a single penny of his salary," he said. She was shocked. "I remember being absolutely astonished," she said later. "It never occurred to me that he wouldn't. It seemed such a little thing to ask." But now Beaverbrook surprised her again. "If you want me to give you a cheque for £3,000," he said, "I will do it for you. But it would be a present," he emphasized, "from him to her." Pamela grew wary. Max had to have control of the people around him, whether it was Brendan Bracken or even Winston Churchill, she said. "I mean, he had to be in the driver's seat, and he just smelled of danger for me." On past occasions, Randolph had warned her about Beaverbrook, telling her never to allow herself to fall under his sway. "Never," Randolph had stressed. "Don't you ever get into Max Beaverbrook's control." Now, in Beaverbrook's office, she said, "Max, I can't do that." She still needed his help, however. She knew she had to find a job in London to begin paying off the debts. Beaverbrook offered a compromise. She could move her son and Nanny into his country home, and he would make sure to look after them. She would then be free to move to London. She accepted the arrangement. She leased her house in Hitchin to a nursery school that had been evacuated from London and made a profit, charging £2 more per week than she herself paid. In London, she took a room on the top floor of the Dorchester, sharing it with Churchill's niece, Clarissa. Not as glamorous or as expensive as that might sound, Clarissa wrote later, since it was not a popular floor to be on during the constant air raids. They paid £6 a week. Clarissa liked Pamela, but noted that she had no sense of humour. What she did have was a gift for making the most of a situation. She combined a canny eye for chances with a genuinely warm heart, Clarissa wrote. Soon after moving in, Pamela found herself at a luncheon at 10 Downing Street, seated beside the Minister of Supply, Sir Andrew Ray Duncan, to whom she mentioned her hope of finding a job in the city. Within 24 hours, she had one, in a division of his ministry that was devoted to establishing hostels for munitions workers assigned to factories far from home. Securing meals for herself was a problem at first. Her room rate at the Dorchester included only breakfast. She had lunch at the Supply Ministry. For dinner, she tried as much as possible to dine at 10 Downing, or with well-off friends. She found herself compelled to hustle for these dinner invitations, but this proved to be an art at which she excelled. It helped, of course, that she was the daughter-in-law of the most important man in Britain. In short order, she and Clarissa had friends and acquaintances on every floor, Clarissa recalled. The two often sheltered from air raids in the room of another resident, Australian Prime Minister Menzies, whom Pamela had come to know well because of her connection to the Churchills. Menzies occupied a large suite on the Dorchester's much-coveted first floor. The women spent nights on mattresses laid out in its windowless entry alcove. Now came the tricky matter of keeping Randolph's gambling fiasco a secret from her in-laws, because I couldn't really tell Clemmy and Winston why, suddenly, from living happily in Hitchin with my baby, I suddenly separated myself from my baby and wanted a job in London. To help cover expenses and begin paying off the debt, Pamela sold her wedding presents, including, she said later, some diamond earrings and a couple of nice bracelets. In the midst of all this, she lost her new pregnancy and blamed the loss on the stress and turmoil in her life. She knew by this point that her marriage was over. She began to feel a new sense of freedom, helped, too, by the fact that soon, on March 20th, 1941, she would celebrate her 21st birthday. She had no inkling, of course, that in a very short while she would fall in love with a handsome older man living a few stories below, on one of the safest floors in the safest hotel in London. Chapter 82. A Treat for Clementine. In New York, on Monday morning, March 10th, Averill Harriman boarded the Atlantic Clipper at LaGuardia's Marine Air Terminal, accompanied by his personal secretary, Robert P. Micklejohn. The skies were clear, the waters of Flushing Bay a hard crystalline blue, with the temperature at 8 a.m. a brisk 29 degrees. The plane he stepped into was a Boeing 314 flying boat, essentially a giant hull with wings and engines. And indeed, the boarding process had more in common with climbing onto a ship than an airplane, including a walk over water on a pier-like boarding ramp. As would have been the case had he been traveling first class on a transatlantic ocean liner, Harriman received a manifest that identified his fellow passengers. The list was like something from a novel by the new international literary sensation Agatha Christie, whose best-selling thriller, And Then There Were None, had been published in the States a year earlier. The British version had the abysmal title, Ten Little, the third word being a crude term for blacks in common usage at the time in Britain and America. The manifest included Antenor Patiño, identified as a Bolivian diplomat, but better known the world over as the Tin King, and Anthony J. Drexel Biddle, Jr., who had been ambassador to Poland during the Nazi invasion, and was now to serve as envoy to various exiled governments in London, travelling with his wife and secretary. There were other British and American diplomats on the list, as well as two couriers and various staff members. A passenger named Antonio Gazda described as an engineer from Switzerland, was in fact an international arms dealer, engaged in selling guns to both sides. Each passenger was allowed 66 pounds of luggage free of charge. Harriman and his secretary brought 2 bags each. Ambassador Biddle brought 34 bags and shipped another 11 on a separate flight. The Clipper pulled away from its moorage, entered Long Island Sound off Queens, and began its takeoff run, bumping across a mile-long fetch of open water before at last lifting off, shedding water like a breaching whale. With a cruising speed of 145 miles per hour, the plane would need about 6 hours to reach its first stop, Bermuda. It flew at 8,000 feet, which pretty much ensured that it would encounter every cloud and storm in its path. There would be turbulence, but also luxury. White-jacketed stewards served full meals on china in a dining compartment with tables, chairs, and tablecloths. At dinner, men wore suits, women dresses. At night, the stewards made up beds in curtained berths. Honeymooners could book a private suite in the plane's tail and swoon at the moonglade on the sea below. As the plane approached Bermuda, stewards closed all the shades, a security measure to keep passengers from surveying the British naval base below. Anyone who peeked was subject to a $500 fine, about $8,000 today. Upon landing, Harriman learned that the next leg of his flight would be delayed until the next day, Tuesday, March 11th, owing to bad weather in the Azores, where clippers had to land on an exposed stretch of the Atlantic. As Harriman waited for the weather to improve, Roosevelt signed the Lend-Lease Bill into law. In Lisbon, Harriman faced another delay. The KLM flight to Bristol, England, was in high demand, and passengers with the most senior official rank, like Ambassador Biddle, took priority. The delay lasted 3 days. Harriman did not suffer, however. He stayed at the Hotel Palacio in Estoril, on the Portuguese Riviera, known both for its luxury and for being a cradle of espionage. Here, in fact, he met briefly with Colonel Donovan, who was now, after his Sunday at Chequers, on his way back to Washington, where he would soon become head of America's top wartime spy agency, the Office of Strategic Services. Ever striving for efficiency, Harriman decided to take advantage of the delay by having the hotel clean his traveling clothes, against the advice of Secretary Micklejohn, who later wrote, ruefully, "Mr. Harriman, in a rash moment, sent his laundry out while he was at the hotel, first receiving a solemn promise that it would be returned before his departure for England." At some point, Harriman went shopping. Given the nature of his mission, he was more aware than most people of the intricacies of Britain's food shortages and rationing rules, and bought a bag of tangerines to give to Churchill's wife. Chequers and its full moon surrogate, Ditchley, were by now a regular weekend ritual for Churchill. These brief sojourns took him away from the increasingly dreary, bomb-worn vistas of London, and solved that need within his English soul for trees, hollows, ponds, and birdsong. He planned to return to Chequers on Friday, March 14th, just 3 days after his last stay, there to receive Roosevelt's latest emissary, if the man ever managed to arrive. Meanwhile, there was much afoot to cause him worry. Bulgaria had just joined the Axis, and soon afterward German forces entered the country, making a feared invasion of Greece on its southern border much more likely. After a period of anguished debate, Churchill decided to honour an existing defence pact with Greece and, on March 9th, dispatched British troops to help fend off the expected onslaught. A risky venture, for it weakened British forces still in Libya and Egypt. The expedition seemed to many to be a lost cause, but at least an honourable one and, as Churchill saw it, an important assertion of Britain's loyalty and its will to fight. As Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden telegraphed from Cairo, "We were prepared to run the risk of failure, thinking it better to suffer with the Greeks than to make no attempt to help them." Meanwhile, a new German general had appeared in the deserts of Libya, with hundreds of panzer tanks at his command and with orders to bolster Italian forces and win back territory lost to the British. General Erwin Rommel, soon to be nicknamed the Desert Fox, had already proven himself in Europe, and now commanded a new army group, the Africa Corps. Harriman at last secured a seat on the flight from Lisbon to Bristol on Saturday, March 15th. His laundry had not been returned. He left instructions with the hotel to forward his clothes to London. As he walked to his plane, a KLM DC-3, he had what he called an eerie experience. He spotted a German aircraft on the tarmac, his first visible marker of the war. Painted black from nose to tail, save for a white swastika, the plane was a jarring presence in that otherwise sun-struck landscape, like a blackened tooth in a gleaming smile. In Germany, Hermann Göring took advantage of a period of fine weather to launch his new campaign against the British Isles, with massed raids that ranged from southern England to Glasgow. On Wednesday, March 12th, a force of 340 German bombers, carrying high-explosive bombs and incendiaries, attacked Liverpool and its surrounding districts, killing more than 500 people. Over the next two nights, the Luftwaffe struck Clydeside, the region encompassing Glasgow, killing 1,085. These raids demonstrated anew the capricious nature of death from the air. A single parachute mine, drifting aimlessly with the wind, destroyed a tenement building and killed 83 civilians. A lone bomb killed 80 more when it penetrated an air raid shelter at a shipyard. Josef Goebbels, writing in his diary on Saturday, March 15th, exulted, "Our flyers are talking of two new Coventries. We shall see how long England can put up with this." To him, as to Göring, the fall of England seemed more likely now than ever, despite the new show of support from America. "We are slowly choking England to death," Goebbels wrote. "One day she will lie gasping on the ground." None of this distracted Luftwaffe chief Göring from his pursuit of art. On Saturday, March 15th, he oversaw delivery of a vast shipment of works seized in Paris and packed onto a train that comprised 25 baggage cars, transporting 4,000 individual pieces ranging from paintings to tapestries to furniture. Harriman arrived in England on Saturday afternoon, 5 days after departing LaGuardia. His KLM flight landed at an airfield outside Bristol at 3:30, in bright and clear weather, as barrage balloons drifted over the adjacent city. He found that Churchill had engineered a surprise. Harriman was supposed to transfer to a British passenger plane for the final flight to London, but instead, Churchill had arranged to have him met by his own naval aide-de-camp, Commander Charles Rafe Tommy Thompson, who tucked Harriman into Churchill's favourite aircraft, his Flamingo. Escorted by two hurricane fighters, they flew through the waning light over English countryside, softened by the first buds and blooms of spring, direct to an airfield near Chequers, where they arrived just in time for dinner. Churchill and Clementine welcomed Harriman with warmth, as if they had known him forever. He presented the tangerines he had bought for Clementine in Lisbon. "I was surprised to see how grateful Mrs. Churchill was," he wrote later. "Her unfeigned delight brought home to me the restrictions of the dreary British wartime diet." After dinner, Churchill and Harriman sat down for their first detailed conversation about how Britain was holding up against Hitler. Harriman told the Prime Minister that he could be useful in promoting Churchill's interests only to the extent that he understood Britain's true condition and the kind of aid Churchill most wanted and what he planned to do with it. "You shall be informed," Churchill told him. "We accept you as a friend. Nothing will be kept from you." Churchill proceeded to assess the threat of invasion, noting how the Germans had assembled fleets of barges at ports in France, Belgium, and Denmark. His biggest concern for the time being, however, was the German submarine campaign against British shipping, which he called the Battle of the Atlantic. In February alone, U-boats, aircraft, and mines had destroyed 400,000 tons of shipping, he told Harriman, and the rate was increasing. Losses per convoy were running at about 10%. The rate at which ships sank was 2 to 3 times faster than the rate at which Britain could build new ones. It was a dire portrait, but Churchill seemed undeterred. Harriman was struck by his resolve to continue the war alone, if need be, and by his frank avowal that, without America's eventual participation, England had no hope of achieving a final victory. A sense of great and fateful change imbued the weekend and left Mary Churchill feeling a kind of awe at being allowed to witness such grave talk. "The weekend was thrilling," she wrote in her diary. "Here was the hub of the universe. For many billions of destinies may perhaps hang on this new axis, this Anglo-American, American-Anglo-friendship." When Harriman at last reached London itself, he found a landscape of contrasts. In one block, he saw untouched homes and clear sidewalks. In the next, mounds of rubble and vertical claws of wood and iron, and half-broken houses with personal belongings splayed across their facades like the battle flags of a lost regiment. Everything was coated with light grey dust, and the scent of combusted tar and wood suffused the air. But the sky was blue, and trees were starting to green, and mists rose off the grass of Hyde Park and the waters of the Serpentine. Commuters streamed from tube stations and double-decker buses, carrying briefcases, newspapers and lunch boxes, but also gas masks and helmets. The ambient sense of threat insinuated itself into everyday choices and decisions, such as the importance of leaving work before nightfall and identifying the nearest shelter, and Harriman's selection of the Dorchester Hotel. The hotel first assigned him a large suite on its sixth floor, rooms 607 through 609, but he deemed this too near the roof. There were only two stories above him, as well as too large and too expensive, and asked to be moved to a smaller suite on the third floor. He directed his secretary, Micklejohn, to haggle for a cheaper rate. Meanwhile, Micklejohn quickly found that even his cheapest room at Claridge's was beyond his means. "We'll have to move out of this place or starve to death," he wrote in his diary after his first night in the hotel. He moved from Claridge's to an apartment that seemed likely to withstand attack. In a letter to a colleague back in the States, he described his satisfaction with the place. He occupied a four-room flat on the eighth floor of a modern building made of steel and brick, with a protective shield of two more floors above. "I even have a view," he wrote. "Opinion differs as to whether it is safer to go in a cellar and have the building fall on you in a raid, or live upstairs and fall on the building. At least, if you are upstairs, you can see what hits you, if there's any comfort in that." He had expected the nightly blackouts to be particularly daunting and depressing, but found this not to be the case. The blackout did make life easier for the pickpockets who frequented train stations and for the looters who plucked valuables from damaged homes and shops, but otherwise, bombs aside, the streets were fundamentally safe. Micklejohn liked walking in the darkness. "Most impressive thing is the silence," he wrote. "Almost everybody walks about like a ghost." Harriman acted quickly to establish his office. Although news accounts portrayed him as a lone paladin striding through chaos, in fact, the Harriman mission, as it became known, soon became a minor empire, with Harriman, Micklejohn, seven more senior men, and a battalion of staff that included 14 stenographers, 10 messengers, 6 file clerks, 2 telephone operators, 4 charwomen, and 1 chauffeur. A benefactor loaned Harriman a Bentley, said to cost £2,000, or $128,000 today. Harriman specified that some of the stenographers and clerks had to be American for handling confidential matters. The mission was lodged first in the U.S. Embassy, at No. 1 Grosvenor Square, but then moved to an adjacent apartment house, where a passage was constructed to link the two buildings. Describing Harriman's office to a friend, Micklejohn wrote, "Mr. Harriman achieves a somewhat Mussolini-like effect, not at all to his liking, by reason of his office being a very large room that used to be the living room of a rather elegant flat." Micklejohn was especially pleased that his own office occupied what had once been the flat's dining room, and adjoined a kitchen with a refrigerator, whose proximity made it easier for him to maintain a supply of foods to help his boss manage periodic flare-ups of a stomach ulcer that had long plagued him. The office itself felt something like a refrigerator. In a letter to the building's manager, Harriman complained that the ambient temperature in the office was 65 degrees, compared to 72 in the embassy next door. There was still no sign of his laundry. The warmth of Churchill's initial greeting was repeated throughout London, with invitations arriving at Harriman's office for lunches, dinners, and weekends in country homes. His desk calendar filled with appointments, first and foremost with Churchill, but also with the Prof, Beaverbrook, and Ismay. His schedule quickly grew complex, and soon his calendar marked out a geographic rhythm repeated over and over. Claridge's, Savoy, Dorchester, Downing, with no written indication of any care given to the possibility of being blown off the planet by the Luftwaffe, save for the monthly moon-governed shift to Ditchley. One of the first invitations to arrive, which Harriman received as soon as he got to London, came from David Niven, who, at age 31, was already an accomplished actor, with film roles ranging from an uncredited slave in the 1934 film Cleopatra to the namesake star in 1939's Raffles. Upon the outbreak of war, Niven had resolved to put his acting career on hold and rejoin the British Army, in which he had served previously from 1929 to 1932. He was now assigned to a commando unit. Niven's decision earned him direct praise from Churchill when the two met at a dinner party while Churchill was still First Lord of the Admiralty. "Young man," Churchill said, shaking his hand, "you did a very fine thing to give up a most promising career to fight for your country." He paused, and with what Niven described as a cheery glint in his eye, added, "Mark you, had you not done so, it would have been despicable." Niven had met Harriman at Sun Valley, and had written now because he was coming to London soon on leave, and wanted to know if Harriman would be available for a meal and a laugh. Niven also offered Harriman a temporary membership in Boodles, his club, with the caveat that, for the time being, all Boodles members were using the Conservative Club, as Boodles had just received a visiting card from the Luftwaffe. "Boodles," Niven wrote, "is very old and very sedate, and the Scarlet Pimpernel used to be a member, but in spite of all that, you can still get the best dinner and are still served by the best staff in London." Harriman held his first press conference on Tuesday, March 18th, his second day in London, and spoke to 54 reporters and photographers. The crowd included 27 British and European reporters, 17 Americans, among them Edward R. Murrow of CBS, and 10 photographers, armed with cameras and flash guns, and with pockets full of one-use bulbs. Like Churchill, Harriman was very aware of public perception and how important it would be during his tenure in London, so much so that after the press conference he asked the editors of two of Beaverbrook's newspapers to canvass their reporters to get their candid impressions of how he had done, without letting them know it was he who was asking. The editor of the Daily Express, Arthur Christensen, replied the next day with the cold report Harriman had requested. "Mr. Harriman was too cagey," Christensen wrote, quoting the Express correspondent who had covered the conference. While his quick smile and great courtesy gave the reporters the impression that he was pleasant and likable, it was evident that he was not going to say anything which could possibly cause him embarrassment at home, a bit too slow in his replies, which increased the atmosphere of caution. Harriman asked for a similar report from Frank Owen, editor of Beaverbrook's Evening Standard, who passed along comments his news editor had gathered that morning from six reporters. "Of course," Owen wrote, "they did not know what the comment was for. They were gossiping quite candidly." Among the remarks, "Too legal and dry. More like a successful English barrister than an American. Too meticulous. He searches too long for the exact phrase which will convey his meaning. This is rather dull." That he was an attractive presence was clear to all. After one later press conference, a female reporter told Harriman's daughter, Kathy, "For God's sake, tell your father next time I have to cover his conference to wear a gas mask so as I can concentrate on what he's saying." That evening, Wednesday, March 19th, at 8:30, Harriman joined Churchill for dinner at 10 Downing Street in its armoured basement dining room and almost immediately gained a close-up appreciation for two things he so far had only heard about: what it was like to experience a major air raid and the sheer courage of the Prime Minister. Chapter 83. Men. When it came to his dining timetable, Churchill made no compromise for bombers. He always had dinner late, as was the case that Wednesday night, when he and Clementine welcomed Harriman to the basement dining room at No. 10, along with two other guests, Ambassador Anthony Biddle and his wife Margaret, both of whom had been aboard Harriman's Atlantic Clipper flight from New York to Lisbon. The night was clear and warm, lighted by a half-moon. Dinner was underway when air raid sirens began their octave-scaling wail, as the first of what would prove to be 500 bombers entered the skies over London's Dock District in the city's East End, carrying high-explosive bombs, parachute mines, and more than 100,000 incendiary canisters. One bomb destroyed a shelter, killing 44 Londoners in an instant. The big parachute mines drifted to earth in Stepney, Poplar, and West Ham, where they destroyed whole blocks of homes. 200 fires began blazing. Dinner proceeded as if no raid were occurring. After the meal, Biddle told Churchill that he would like to see for himself the strides which London had made in air raid precautions, at which point Churchill invited him and Harriman to accompany him to the roof. The raid was still in progress. Along the way, they put on steel helmets and collected John Colville and Eric Seal, so that they too, as Colville put it, could watch the fun. Getting to the roof took effort. A fantastic climb it was, Seal said in a letter to his wife, up ladders, a long circular stairway, and a tiny manhole right at the top of a tower. Nearby, anti-aircraft guns blasted away. The night sky filled with spears of light as searchlight crews hunted the bombers above. Now and then, aircraft appeared silhouetted against the moon and the starlit sky. Engines roared high overhead in a continuous thrum. Churchill and his helmeted entourage stayed on the roof for 2 hours. All the while, Biddle wrote in a letter to President Roosevelt, he received reports at various intervals from the different sections of the city hit by the bombs. It was intensely interesting. Biddle was impressed by Churchill's evident courage and energy. In the midst of it all, as guns fired and bombs erupted in the distance, Churchill quoted Tennyson, part of an 1842 monologue called Locksley Hall, in which the poet wrote, with prescience, "Heard the heavens fill with shouting, and there rained a ghastly dew from the nation's airy navies grappling in the central blue." On the roof, at least, all survived. But in the course of the six-hour raid, 500 Londoners lost their lives. In the city's West Ham district alone, bombs killed 204 people, all taken to the Municipal Baths mortuary on Romford Road, where, according to a Scotland Yard inspector's report, the mortuary men, heedless of time and food, and in the stench of flesh and blood, classifying and taking descriptions of the mutilated human remains and fragments of bodies and limbs, managed to identify all but three victims. Later, Ambassador Biddle sent Churchill a note, thanking him for the experience and complimenting him on his leadership and courage. "It was grand being with you," he said. It was a measure of the ambient courage of London in 1941 that Harriman now decided to invite his daughter Cathy, a 23-year-old reporter and recent Bennington College graduate, to come live with him in England. There was courage. There was despair. On Friday, March 28th, the writer Virginia Woolf, her depression worsened by the war and the destruction of both her house in Bloomsbury and her subsequent residence, composed a note to her husband Leonard and left it for him at their country home in East Sussex. "Dearest," she wrote, "I feel certain that I am going mad again. I feel we can't go through another of those terrible times, and I shan't recover this time. I begin to hear voices, and I can't concentrate. So I am doing what seems the best thing to do." Her hat and cane were found on a bank of the nearby River Ouse. At Chequers, the turf applied to the entry lanes during the preceding winter had succeeded in making them invisible from the air. But now, in March, a new problem arose. While flying over Chequers, two pilots from the RAF's photographic reconnaissance unit made a startling discovery. Someone had ploughed up the U-shaped area formed where the lanes arc to the front and back of the house, leaving a broad half-moon of pale earth. The ploughing, moreover, had been done in a most peculiar way, as though the ploughman were deliberately trying to depict the head of a trident aimed at the house. The pale, raw soil nullified the camouflage effect of the turf, thus putting us back more or less where we were at the start, but, if anything, rather more so, wrote an official of the Ministry of Home Security Civil Defence Camouflage Establishment. So deliberate did this first seem that Detective Inspector Thompson, Churchill's security man, suspected foul play. He made inquiries on the morning of March 23rd and located the culprit, a tenant farmer named David Rogers, who explained that he had ploughed the area, hoping only to make maximum use of all available ground. He was simply trying to grow as much food as possible for the war effort under the Grow More Food campaign. Thompson decided that the man was in fact not a fifth columnist and that he had produced the pattern by accident, according to a report on the matter. On Monday, March 24th, workers using heavy-duty tractors resolved the problem by ploughing adjacent terrain so that from the air the ploughed land looked like an ordinary rectangular field. The ground, naturally, will show up very white for some days, the report said, but the directional indication will be completely obliterated and the ground will be sown with quick-growing seeds. Another problem remained, the inevitable presence of the many parked cars when Churchill was at the house. The phenomenon often thwarted camouflage efforts, wrote Philip James of the Camouflage Establishment. Not only would a number of cars outside Chequers clearly indicate the probable presence of the Prime Minister, but it might equally draw the attention of an enemy airman who would otherwise have passed by without giving any particular attention to the house. He urged that cars either be covered or parked under trees. The fact remained that Chequers was a clear and obvious target, well within the reach of German bombers and fighters. Given the Luftwaffe's prowess at low-altitude bombing, it seemed something of a miracle the Chequers were standing at all. That the air war would continue throughout the year and into the next seemed obvious to Churchill, as did the fact that continued bombardment posed a political hazard. Londoners had proven they could take it, but how much longer would they be able to do so? Having deemed the reform of air raid shelters to be crucial, he hectored his Minister of Health, Malcolm MacDonald, to make a wide range of improvements before the next winter. He wanted particular attention paid to flooring and drainage, and urged that shelters be equipped with radios and gramophones. In a second memorandum that weekend, this to both MacDonald and Minister of Home Security Morrison, Churchill also emphasised the need for inspecting the personal Anderson air raid shelters Londoners had installed in their gardens and told the ministers, those that are waterlogged should either be removed or their owners helped to give them a good foundation. One result of Churchill's interest was a pamphlet that advised citizens on how best to use their Anderson shelters. A sleeping bag with a hot bottle or brick in it will keep you beautifully warm, it said, and recommended bringing in a tin of biscuits during air raids, in case the children wake up hungry in the night. Oil lamps posed a danger, it warned, as they may get spilled either by shock from a bomb or by accident. The pamphlet also had advice for dog owners. If you take your dog into your shelter, you should muzzle him. Dogs are liable to become hysterical if bombs explode nearby. As Churchill said later, if we can't be safe, let us at least be comfortable. That weekend, Mary Churchill and a friend, Charles Ritchie, set off by train for a visit to Stansted Park, the home of Lord Bessborough, where John Colville and Bessborough's daughter, Moira, had investigated a fallen bomber the previous summer. Mary and Charles and other young people in their circle were massing at the house for the weekend in order to attend a big dance at the Tangmere RAF base, one of the most important and most heavily bombed airfields in England, about a half hour's drive away. The RAF was perhaps banking on the night's new moon, the phase when the moon is utterly black, to reduce the likelihood of German attack during the dance. Mary and Charles took a train from London's Waterloo Station, riding in first class, snug under throw blankets. We rather monopolised the carriage, she wrote in her diary, by putting our feet up and covering ourselves with rugs. At one station, a woman looked into their compartment and gave them a knowing look. Oh, I won't disturb you, the woman said, then rushed away. Dear me, Mary wrote. They arrived at Stansted Park in time for afternoon tea. Mary met Moira for the first time and was pleasantly surprised. I was rather alarmed by what I had been previously told, but she turned out to be the best of company, reserved but gay. She also met Moira's brother, Lord Duncannon, Eric, an officer in the Royal Artillery. He was 9 years older than she, and a survivor of the Dunkirk evacuation. She looked him over and, in her diary, pronounced him good-looking in rather a lyrical way. Very beautiful grey, wide-set eyes, melodious voice, charming and easy. John Colville knew him and had a contrasting opinion. Eric, he wrote, cannot avoid saying things of such futile egotism that he makes even Moira blush. He is indeed a fantastic creature. After tea, Mary, Moira, Eric, and the other young guests, La Jeunesse, Mary wrote, got ready for the dance, then gathered downstairs. They were on the verge of departure when a bank of nearby anti-aircraft guns began to fire. Once the noise subsided, they set out for the airbase. With no moon, the night was especially dark, barely penetrated by the slit-eyed headlights of the cars. At the party, she met one of the RAF's most famous aces, Squadron Leader Douglas Bader, 31 years old. He had lost both legs in an air crash a decade earlier, but with the advent of war and the shortage of pilots, he had been approved for combat and quickly accumulated victories. He walked with two prosthetic legs and never used crutches or a walking stick. "He's marvellous," Mary wrote. "I danced with him, and he's so extraordinarily good. He is exemplary of the triumph of life and mind and personality over matter." But the man who most commanded her attention was Eric. She danced with him throughout the night, and after noting this in her diary, she quoted Hilaire Belloc's very short 1910 poem, The False Heart. "I said to Heart, 'How goes it?' Heart replied, 'Right as a ribstone, Pippin.' But it lied." Mary added, "No comment." Late in the party, the lights failed, and the dance floor went dark. Not an altogether unwelcome event to many, I think. It was all great fun, she wrote, but distinctly an orgy and rather bizarre. They returned to Stansted under a sable sky flecked with planets and stars. Saturday night in London was exceptionally dark, so much so that when Harriman's secretary, Micklejohn, went to Paddington Station to meet a new member of the mission's staff, the combination of no moon and blacked-out platforms made it impossible to see who was getting off the trains. The secretary had brought a flashlight and wore a coat with a fur collar, which the new man had been told to look for. After searching in vain for a while, Micklejohn got the idea to situate himself in a prominent spot and use his light to illuminate his collar. The man found him. Harriman left the city that night for another stay at Chequers, this time accompanied by America's new ambassador, John G. Winant, appointed by Roosevelt to replace Joseph Kennedy, who, increasingly out of favor, had resigned late the previous year. Both Winant and Harriman came to dine and sleep. Over dinner, Harriman sat opposite Churchill's daughter-in-law, Pamela. In describing the moment later, she wrote, "I saw the best-looking man I had ever seen." He was much older than she acknowledged. But from early on she had recognized in herself an affinity for older men. "I wasn't amused or interested in people my own age," she said. "What attracted me was much older men, and I felt very at ease with them." She had never felt wholly comfortable with members of her own generation. "Luckily for me, the war came, so then it sort of didn't matter, and I immediately spent time with people much older than myself, and found myself quite happily entertaining whoever it might be." That Harriman was married struck her as irrelevant. It struck him the same way. By the time of his arrival in London, his marriage had stalled on a plateau of mutual respect and sexual disinterest. His wife, Marie Norton Whitney, was a dozen years younger and ran an art gallery in New York. They had met in 1928, while she was married to a rich New York playboy, Cornelius Vanderbilt Whitney. She and Harriman married in February 1930, after Harriman divorced his first wife. By now, however, both had begun having affairs. Mrs. Harriman was widely thought to be sleeping with Eddie Duchin, a handsome and trim New York bandleader. Duchin, too, was married. Pamela's own marriage was in lightning decline, and as it devolved, her sense of freedom grew. A more exciting life seemed certain to lie ahead. She was young and beautiful, and at the center of Churchill's circle. She wrote, "It was a terrible war, but if you were the right age, at the right time and in the right place, it was spectacular." Given Harriman's ubiquity within Churchill's circle, it was clear that Pamela and he would encounter each other again, and often, much to the glee of Max Beaverbrook, Minister of Aircraft Production and Collector of Secrets, known to some as the Minister of Midnight. The mood at Chequers that weekend was bright for other reasons as well. Over the preceding days, British forces had seized important ground in Eritrea and Ethiopia, and an anti-German coup in Yugoslavia had installed a new government, which promptly nullified the country's existing pact with Hitler. On Friday, March 28th, Churchill sent a cheery telegram to Harry Hopkins in Washington, stating, "Yesterday was a grand day," and noting, too, that he was in closest touch with Harriman. John Colville, in his diary, wrote that Churchill has spent much of the weekend pacing, or rather tripping, up and down the great hall to the sound of the gramophone, playing martial airs, waltzes, and the most vulgar kind of brass band songs, deep in thought the while. Sunday brought still more good news. In a battle off Cape Matapan, Greece, the Royal Navy, aided by intelligence from Bletchley Park, had engaged and effectively crippled the Italian Navy, already shaken by a defeat the previous fall. Mary Churchill, still at Stansted Park and savouring the delights of the prior night's dance, was elated by the news. "All day we felt jubilant," she wrote in her diary. That afternoon she and Eric Duncannon took a long walk through the fragrant spring landscape of the estate's parklands. "I think he is charming," she wrote. As Eric left that day to return to his unit, he said those fatal words, "May I ring you up?" Two meetings, two country homes, one lovely weekend in March, with victory suddenly seeming a bit more near. Of such moments are great family upheavals sown. Part 6. Love Amid the Flames. April to May. Chapter 84. Grave News. On Tuesday, April 1st, Mary's room at Chequers, the prison room, was exceptionally cold. The promise of spring had given way to a reprise of winter, as noted in her diary. Snow, sleet, cold, not funny. She went to work at her women's voluntary service office, then had lunch with her sister Sarah, who told her a bit of gossip about Eric Duncannon and another woman. "Very interesting," Mary wrote. 2 days later, Thursday, April 3rd, she received a letter from Eric. "A very sweet letter at that," she wrote. She counselled herself, "Now, Mary, take a hold on yourself, my little plum." And shortly after this, she received a second letter from him, this one inviting her out to dinner the following week. "Oh, heaven," she wrote. The next day, Sunday, another bitterly cold day, Eric telephoned, sending a tremor of intrigue tingling through the house, which, as always, was well populated with guests, including Harriman, Pamela, Pug Ismay, Air Marshal Sholto Douglas, and others. Eric and Mary spoke for 20 minutes. "He is very charming, I think, and has a very beautiful voice," Mary wrote in her diary. "Oh dear, have I fallen, or have I?" For Mary, these communications offered a sparkle of relief from the downhearted atmosphere that otherwise suffused the house, the result of a sudden reversal of fortune in the Middle East and bad news from the Balkans. Where, just a week earlier, the mood at Chequers had been confident and bright, now there was gloom. A sudden German advance had forced the British to abandon Benghazi, yet one more evacuation. And at dawn that Sunday, April 6th, before Eric called, German forces had staged a full-scale invasion of Yugoslavia, codenamed Operation Retribution, as punishment for turning against Hitler, and also attacked Greece. Troubled by these events and by their likely effect on her father, Mary decided to brave the frozen weather and attend a morning service in nearby Ellsborough. "Went to church and found great comfort and encouragement there," she wrote in her diary. "Prayed very hard for Papa." The next morning, before leaving for work, she stopped by Churchill's office to say goodbye, and found him reading documents. "He looked tired," I thought, "grim, sorrowful." He told her he expected this to be a week of very bad news, and urged her to keep up her morale. "Darling," she wrote in her diary, "I will try. Perhaps I can help in that way." But she felt this to be a pale contribution. "It is thwarting to feel so ardently about our cause, and yet to be so unavailing, and so weak, for I, who am really very happy and comfortable, have gay friends and rather a butterfly disposition, little or no cares. I allow myself to feel despondent, gloomy." Not entirely gloomy, however. She spent a good deal of time musing about Eric Duncannon, who now occupied an inordinate share of her imagination, even though she had met him just 9 days earlier. "I wish I knew whether I am in love with Eric, rather, or whether I simply have a crush." The week did bring bad news, as Churchill had predicted. In Libya, Erwin Rommel's tanks continued to gain ground against British forces, prompting the British general in command, Archibald Wavell, to cable on April 7th that conditions had greatly deteriorated. Churchill urged Wavell to defend the port city of Tobruk at all costs, calling it a place to be held to the death, without thought of retirement. So intent was Churchill on this, and on personally understanding the battlefield, that he ordered Pug Ismay to deliver to him plans and a model of Tobruk, adding, "Let me have meanwhile the best photographs available both from the air and from the ground." News arrived, too, of the toll wrought by Hitler's Operation Retribution against Yugoslavia, designed to send a message to any vassal state that sought to resist, and also, perhaps, to show Londoners what lay ahead for them. The aerial assault, which began on Palm Sunday, levelled the capital, Belgrade, and killed 17,000 civilians. This news struck close to home, for that same week, in an unfortunate confluence, British officials announced that the total number of civilian deaths in Britain, caused by German air raids, had reached 29,856, and this was just the number of lives lost. Injuries, many catastrophic and disfiguring, far outnumbered the death toll. On top of this came renewed fears that Hitler might yet invade England. Hitler's apparent new focus on Russia, as revealed by intelligence intercepts, did not in itself guarantee that the danger had passed. In a note to Edward Bridges, Secretary to the War Cabinet, on Tuesday, April 8th, Churchill ordered all his ministers to coordinate their vacations for the upcoming Easter holiday to ensure that key offices were manned and that the ministers themselves were readily available by telephone. "I am told," Churchill wrote, "that Easter is a very good time for invasion." Over the Easter weekend, the moon would be full. In a speech the next day on the war situation, which he had scheduled originally to congratulate British forces on their victories, he talked of the new reversals and of the war spreading to Greece and the Balkans. He emphasized the importance of American aid, especially a gigantic increase in America's construction of merchant ships. He also raised the specter of invasion. "That is an ordeal from which we shall not shrink," he told the House, but added that Germany clearly had designs on Russia, in particular the Ukraine, and oil fields in the Caucasus. He ended on an optimistic note, proclaiming that once Britain had overcome the submarine menace and American lend-lease supplies began to flow, Hitler could be sure that, armed with the sword of retributive justice, we shall be on his track. The bad news, however, was too overwhelming to be countered by a mere gleam of optimism. "The House is sad and glum," Harold Nicholson wrote in his diary. What seemed clear to Nicholson was that Churchill, more than ever, was staking his hopes and Britain's future on Roosevelt. Nicholson took note of the Prime Minister's several references to America, seeing in them grave meaning. "His peroration implies that we are done without American help." Harriman watched the speech from the Distinguished Strangers Gallery in the House. Afterward, he wrote a lengthy letter to Roosevelt, in which he marvelled at the extent to which the faith and hopes for the future of the people here are bound up in America, and in you, personally. He noted that the coming weekend would be his fifth in England, and the fourth he would spend with Churchill. "He seems to get confidence in having us around," Harriman said, "feeling perhaps that we represent you and the aid that America is to give." Churchill placed much weight on Roosevelt's assurances, Harriman observed. "You are his one strong, dependable friend." Harriman closed his letter with a brief paragraph, one he appeared to add as an afterthought. "England's strength is bleeding. In our own interest, I trust our Navy can be directly employed before our partner is too weak." For Mary, the news from the Balkans was particularly distressing. The depth of misery Hitler had inflicted on Yugoslavia seemed almost beyond fathoming. "If one could really completely imagine the full horror of the struggle all the time, I suppose life would be insupportable," she wrote. "As it is, moments of realization are bad enough." The news left her feeling gloomed up, she wrote on Thursday, April 10th, though she was still excited about seeing Eric that evening. He brought her a copy of the works of John Donne. Even more exciting was the prospect of setting off that night with her parents on one of Churchill's damage tours, first to the badly bombed Welsh city of Swansea, and then to Bristol, where her father, in his titular role as Chancellor of the city's namesake university, was also scheduled to confer a number of honorary degrees. Earlier that day, though, Mary and her parents had received some wrenching family news. Her sister, Diana's husband, Duncan Sands, had been seriously hurt in a car accident. "Poor Diana," she wrote. "However, thank God, it seems it is not quite as serious as we thought at first." Churchill wrote about the crash in a letter to his son Randolph in Cairo. "You know Duncan had a frightful accident. He was going down in a car from London to Aberporth and was lying down asleep with his shoes off. He had two drivers, but both fell asleep simultaneously. The car ran into a stone bridge, which narrowed the road suddenly, and both his feet are smashed up. Also, some injury to his spine." Whether Sands would be able to return to his duties as a colonel in the anti-aircraft command was unclear, Churchill wrote, "but it is possible he may be able to return to his duties by hobbling about. If not," Churchill added with a wry quip, "there is always the House of Commons." In the evening, Mary and her parents, Papa and Mummy, boarded Churchill's special train, where they were joined by other invited travellers: Harriman, Ambassador Wynant, Australian Prime Minister Menzies, Pug Ismay, John Colville, and several senior military officials. The Prof was supposed to go too, but was laid up with a cold. They arrived in Swansea at 8 o'clock the next morning, Good Friday, and set off to tour the city in a caravan of cars, with Churchill seated in an open Ford, with a cigar clenched between his teeth. They travelled through a landscape of utter destruction. "The devastation in parts of the town is ghastly," Mary wrote in her diary, but now she witnessed firsthand the extent to which the city's populace needed this visit from her father, and how they seemed to revere him. "Never have I seen such courage, love, cheerfulness and confidence expressed as by the people today. Wherever he went, they swarmed around Papa, clasping his hand, patting him on the back, shouting his name." She found it very moving, but also disconcerting. "It is rather frightening how terribly they depend on him," she wrote. The train took them next to an experimental weapons testing station on the Welsh coast, where Churchill and his party were to observe trials of various aerial mines and rocket launchers. The prospect at first delighted Churchill, appealing to the little boy that lurked in his soul, but the tests did not go well. "The firing of the rockets was bad," John Colville wrote, "and at the first display a childishly easy target was repeatedly missed, but the multiple projectors seemed promising. So did the aerial mines descending with parachutes." It was when the train arrived at Bristol the next day, Saturday, April 12th, that the journey turned surreal. The train stopped for the night on a siding outside the city, a prudent measure given the recent intensification of German air raids, and the fact that the night was clear, the moon at its fullest. And indeed, starting at 10 p.m., 150 German bombers, guided both by navigation beams and by moonlight reckoning, began attacking the city, first with incendiaries, then with high explosives, in one of the most severe raids Bristol had suffered thus far. The raid, subsequently dubbed the Good Friday Raid, lasted 6 hours, during which the bombers dropped nearly 200 tons of high explosives and 37,000 incendiary bombs, killing 180 civilians and wounding another 382. A single bomb killed 10 rescue workers. It blew three of the victims onto the adjacent tarmac road, where they were partially absorbed into its suddenly molten surface. They were later discovered by an unlucky ambulance driver who had the unenviable task of prying their bodies loose. Aboard the train, Churchill and his party heard the distant guns and detonations. Wrote Pug Ismay, "It was clear that Bristol was getting it hot." The next morning, Saturday, the train pulled into the Bristol station as fire still burned and smoke bloomed from demolished buildings. At least 100 bombs had failed to explode, either because of malfunction or by design, thereby hampering rescue crews and fire squads, and making Churchill's choice of route through the city a risky and problematic matter. The morning was grey and cold, as Mary recalled it, and wreckage was strewn everywhere. She saw men and women heading off to their jobs, as on any other day, but clearly worn by the night's raid. "Rather strained, pale faces, weary, silent," she wrote. First Churchill and company went to the city's Grand Hotel. The building had survived the night's raid unscathed, but prior raids had inflicted considerable damage. It had a sense of lean to it, as if it needed shoring up in order to stay in business, wrote Inspector Thompson. Churchill requested a bath.
Yes, sir,
the desk manager said brightly, as if this posed no challenge whatsoever, when, in fact, prior raids had left the hotel with no hot water. But somehow, somewhere in but a few minutes, Thompson said, an amused procession of guests, clerks, cooks, maids, soldiers, and walking wounded materialized out of some mystery in the back part of the building and went up the stairs with hot water in all types of containers, including a garden sprinkler, and filled the tub in the Prime Minister's room. Churchill and the others convened for breakfast. Harriman noticed that the hotel staff seemed to have been up all night. The waiter serving breakfast had been working on the roof of the hotel and had helped to put a number of incendiaries out, he wrote in a letter to Roosevelt. After breakfast, the group set out to tour the city, with Churchill seated on the folded canvas top of an open touring car. In British English, this was the Hood. The devastation, wrote John Colville, was such as I had never thought possible. Churchill's visit was unannounced. As he drove through the streets, people turned to watch. First came recognition, Mary saw, then surprise and delight. Mary rode in the same car as Harriman. She liked him. He has the roots of the matter in him, she wrote. He feels and works for us so much. The caravan moved past residents who stood in front of their newly ruined houses, examining the remains and retrieving belongings. Upon seeing Churchill, they came running to his car. It was unbelievably moving, Mary wrote. Churchill toured the worst-hit areas on foot. He walked briskly. This was not the halting meander that might have been expected of an overweight 66-year-old man who spent many of his waking hours drinking and smoking. Newsreel footage shows him charging along at the head of his entourage, smiling, scowling, now and then doffing his bowler hat, even executing an occasional snappy pirouette to acknowledge a remark from a bystander. In his long overcoat, over his round frame, he looked like the top half of a very large bomb. Clementine and Mary walked a few steps behind, both looking happy and cheerful. Pug, Ismay, and Harriman followed as well. Inspector Thompson stayed close, one hand in his pistol pocket. When engulfed by a crowd of men and women, Churchill took off his bowler and put it on top of his walking stick, then held it aloft, so that those outside the immediate crush could see it and know he was there. "Stand back, my men," Harriman heard him say. "Let the others see." Harriman noticed that as Churchill moved among the crowds, he used his trick of making direct eye contact with individuals. At one point, believing Churchill to be out of earshot, Harriman told Pug Ismay, "The Prime Minister seems popular with the middle-aged women." Churchill heard the remark. He whirled to face Harriman. "What did you say? Not only with the middle-aged women, with the young ones, too." The procession moved on to Bristol University for the degree ceremony. "Nothing could have been more dramatic," Harriman wrote. The building next door was still in flames. Churchill, in full academic regalia, sat on the dais among similarly attired university officials, many of whom had spent the night helping fight fires. Despite the raid and the wreckage outside, the hall filled. "It was quite extraordinary," Mary wrote. "People kept on arriving late with grime on their faces, half washed off, their ceremonial robes on, over their firefighting clothes which were still wet." Churchill conferred degrees upon Ambassador Wynant and Australian Prime Minister Menzies, and, in absentia, on Harvard President James Conant, who had returned to America. Before the ceremony, he'd quipped to Harriman, "I'd like to give you a degree, but you're not interested in that sort of thing." Later in the ceremony, Churchill rose and gave an impromptu speech. "Many of those here today have been all night at their posts," he said, "and all have been under the fire of the enemy in heavy and protracted bombardment. That you should gather in this way is a mark of fortitude and phlegm, of a courage and detachment from material affairs, worthy of all that we have learned to believe of ancient Rome or of modern Greece." He told the audience that he tried to get away from headquarters as much as possible to visit bombed areas, "and I see the damage done by the enemy attacks. But I also see, side by side with the devastation and amid the ruins, quiet, confident, bright, and smiling eyes, beaming with a consciousness of being associated with a cause far higher than any human or personal issue. I see the spirit of an unconquerable people." Afterward, as Churchill, Clementine, and the others emerged on the steps of the university, a large crowd surged forward, cheering. And at that instant, in a singular moment of meteorological synchronicity, the sun broke through the clouds. As the cars headed back to the train station, the crowd followed. For all the laughing and cheering, it could have been a city festival from more peaceful times. Men, women, and children walked beside Churchill's car, their faces gleaming with delight. "These are not mere fair-weather friends," Mary wrote in her diary. "Papa has served them with his heart and his mind always, through peace and wars, and they have given him in his finest and darkest hour their love and confidence." She was struck by the strange power of her father to bring forth courage and strength in the most trying of circumstances. "Oh, please, dear God," she wrote, "preserve him unto us, and lead us to victory and peace." As the train departed, Churchill waved at the crowd from the windows, and kept waving until the train was out of sight. Then, reaching for a newspaper, he sat back and raised the paper to mask his tears. "They have such confidence," he said. "It is a grave responsibility." They arrived at Chequers in time for dinner, where they were joined by a number of new guests, including Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden and his wife, and General Dill, Chief of the Imperial General Staff. The atmosphere was somber at first, as Churchill, Dill, and Eden grappled with the latest news from the Middle East and the Mediterranean. German forces in Greece were advancing quickly toward Athens and threatened to overwhelm Greek and British defenders, raising the prospect of yet another evacuation. Rommel's tanks in Libya continued to pummel British forces, forcing them to retreat toward Egypt and to concentrate in Tobruk. That night, Churchill sent a cable to General Wavell, commander of British forces in the Middle East, telling him that he, Dill, and Eden had complete confidence in him, and emphasizing how important it was for Wavell to resist the German advance. "This," Churchill wrote, "is one of the crucial fights in the history of the British Army." He also urged Wavell to please spell Tobruk with a K, as opposed to such other spellings as Tobruk and Tobruk. A telegram from Roosevelt dissipated the gloom. The president notified Churchill that he had decided to extend the American naval security zone in the North Atlantic to include all waters between the U.S. coast and the 25th meridian west, roughly two-thirds of the Atlantic Ocean, and to take other measures which will favorably affect your shipping problem. He planned to do so immediately. "It is important for domestic political reasons, which you will readily understand, that this action be taken by us unilaterally, and not after diplomatic conversations between you and us. U.S. ships and aircraft would now patrol these waters. We will want, in great secrecy, notification of movement of convoys, so our patrol units can seek out any ships or planes or aggressor nations operating west of the new line of the security zone," Roosevelt stated. "The United States would then convey to the Royal Navy the locations of any enemy vessels they encountered." Churchill was elated. On Easter Sunday, April 13th, from Chequers, he sent his thanks to the president. "Deeply grateful for your momentous cable," he wrote. He called the move a long step towards salvation. Colville asked Harriman whether it meant that America and Germany would now go to war. Harriman said, "That's what I hope." So moved was Harriman by his experience at Bristol that he overcame his pinch-penny nature and made an anonymous donation to the city in the amount of £100, about $6,400 in 21st century dollars. To keep his role confidential, he asked Clementine to forward the money to the city's mayor. In a handwritten thank you on Tuesday, April 15th, she told him, "Whatever happens, we do not feel alone anymore." That day, too, Harriman learned that his daughter Kathy, thanks to the intercession of Harry Hopkins, had at last received approval by the State Department to travel to London. "Thrilled," he telegraphed immediately. "When are you coming? Bring all possible nylon stockings for your friends here. Also, dozen packs Stimudent for another friend." He was referring to Stimudent, a toothpick-like product used to clean between teeth and stimulate blood flow in the gums, once so popular that the Smithsonian eventually acquired a specimen for its permanent collection. In another cable, Harriman urged, "Don't forget Stimulants." He told Kathy to bring whatever lipstick she favoured, but also to include a few tubes of Green Top lipstick by Guerlain. His insistent pleas for the Stimulants drew the bemused attention of his wife, Marie. "We're all dying to know who the peeress with the decayed teeth is, who's in such a lather about her toothpicks," she wrote. She added, "After your third cable about them, we decided the situation must be critical." Gloom settled over meetings of the War Cabinet. The loss of Benghazi and the seemingly imminent fall of Tobruk were especially disheartening. A melancholy suffused England that was all the more pronounced because of the contrast between the hopes raised by the winter's victories and the deflation that accompanied the new reversals, and by the intensified German air raids, some of which were even deadlier and more damaging than those of the prior fall. German bombers again struck Coventry, and the next night Birmingham. Darkness continued to stymie the RAF. Within the House of Commons, discontent deepened. At least one prominent member, Lloyd George, was growing concerned about whether Churchill was indeed the man to wage this war to victory. Chapter 85. Scorn. At his morning meeting on Tuesday, April 15th, Joseph Goebbels instructed his propagandists to concentrate on deriding Britain for its imminent retreat from Greece. Churchill should be pilloried as a gambler, as a character more at home at the tables in Monte Carlo than in the seat of a British Prime Minister. A typical gambler's nature, cynical, ruthless, brutal, staking the blood of other nations in order to save British blood, riding roughshod over the national destinies of small states. The press was to repeat over and over, with savage scorn, the slogan, "Instead of butter, Benghazi. Instead of Benghazi, Greece. Instead of Greece, nothing." He added, "This, then, is the end." Hermann Göring certainly hoped that Britain was, at last, near surrender, and set about making sure that he and his beloved Air Force would get the credit. But the RAF was causing him grief. A week earlier, British bombers had struck at the heart of Berlin, shattering the city's finest avenue, the Unter den Linden, and destroying the State Opera House, shortly before a much-anticipated guest performance by an Italian opera company. "Hitler was outraged," wrote Nikolaus von Below, his Luftwaffe liaison, "and as a result he had a furious argument with Göring." Hitler's fury and Göring's resentment both likely played a part in the ferocity with which Göring now proposed to execute a series of new attacks on London, the first set to take place on Wednesday, April 16th. Churchill was annoyed. Nearly 2 weeks earlier, he had dispatched a cryptic warning to Stalin, hinting at Hitler's invasion plans. Cryptic because he did not want to reveal that Bletchley Park was the source of his own detailed knowledge about Operation Barbarossa. He sent the message to his ambassador to Russia, Sir Stafford Cripps, with instructions to deliver it in person. Now, in that week after Easter, Churchill learned that Cripps had never delivered it. Angered by this apparent act of insubordination, Churchill wrote to the ambassador's boss, Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden, "I set special importance on the delivery of this personal message from me to Stalin," he wrote. "I cannot understand why it should be resisted. The ambassador is not alive to the military significance of the facts. Pray oblige me." By now, it was clear to anyone who worked with Churchill that any request beginning with "pray" was a direct and non-negotiable command. Cripps at last delivered Churchill's warning. Stalin did not reply. Chapter 86. That night at the Dorchester. Averill Harriman left his office early that Wednesday, April 16th, to get a haircut. Barbershops closed at 6:30 p.m. He was to attend a formal dinner that night at the Dorchester Hotel, honouring Fred Astaire's sister, Adele. This had been a big day for the Harriman mission. In Washington, Roosevelt had signed off on the first transfer of food under the Lend-Lease Act, 11,000 tons of cheese, 11,000 tons of eggs, and 100,000 cases of evaporated milk. Harriman's early departure from the office gave his secretary, Robert Micklejohn, a chance to have an early dinner for once. The evening was lovely and clear. At 9 o'clock, an hour after sunset, air raid sirens activated throughout London. They drew little attention at first. The sound of sirens was by now a commonplace event. The only thing that distinguished this alert from those of the prior days was its timing, an hour earlier than usual. In Bloomsbury, flares began to fall, flooding the streets with brilliant light. Author Graham Greene, whose novel The Power and the Glory had been published the previous year, was just finishing dinner with his mistress, writer Dorothy Glover. Both were about to go on duty, he as an air raid warden, she as a fire watcher. Green accompanied her to her assigned lookout. Standing on the roof of a garage, we saw the flares come slowly floating down, dribbling their flames, Green wrote in his journal. They drift like great yellow peonies. The moon-flushed sky filled with the silhouettes of hundreds of aircraft. Now bombs fell, of all sizes, including giant parachute mines, gargantuan parodies of the Prof's own aerial mines. There was confusion, dust, fire, broken glass. A mine landed on the Victoria Club in Mallet Street, where 350 Canadian soldiers were sleeping. Green arrived and found chaos. Soldiers still coming out in grey, blood-smeared pyjamas, pavements littered by glass, and some were barefooted. Where the building had stood, there was now a jagged 20-foot escarpment that seemed to extend deep into the foundation. The bombers overhead droned without interruption. One really thought that this was the end, Green wrote, but it wasn't exactly frightening. One had ceased to believe in the possibility of surviving the night. Incidents accumulated. A bomb destroyed a Jewish girls' club, killing 30 people. A parachute mine destroyed an anti-aircraft outpost in Hyde Park. In the ruins of a pub, a priest crawled under a billiard table to take confession from the owner and his family, trapped by debris. Despite the ongoing raid, John Colville left 10 Downing Street and climbed into Churchill's armoured car, which then took him through newly blasted and flaming streets to the American Embassy in Grosvenor Square. He met with U.S. Ambassador Wynant to discuss a telegram Churchill planned to send to Roosevelt. At 1:45 a.m., he left the embassy to return to 10 Downing, this time on foot. Bombs fell around him like hailstones, he wrote. He added, with a degree of understatement, "I had quite a disagreeable walk." Harriman's secretary, Robert Micklejohn, having finished dinner, went to the roof of the American Embassy, along with members of the embassy staff. He climbed to the highest point, which gave him a 360-degree view of the city. Now, for the first time since he had arrived in London, he heard the whistling sound made by falling bombs. He did not like it. "More scary than actual explosions," he wrote in his journal. He added, "Did a couple of tumbling acts, in which I had plenty of company to dodge bombs that fell blocks away." Immense explosions, likely from parachute mines, occurred within view, shaking the earth. "It looked as if whole houses were sailing up in the air," he wrote. At one point, Ambassador Wynant and his wife came to the roof but did not linger. They took mattresses from their flat on the fifth floor of the embassy and carried them to the first. Micklejohn saw a bomb detonate at the Battersea Power Station in the distance. The bomb ignited a large gas storage tank, which blew up in a column of fire that seemed to go up miles. He went back to his own flat and tried to sleep, but after an hour he gave up. Nearby detonations caused the building to shudder and sent shrapnel clattering against his windows. He climbed to his roof and there was met by the most amazing sight I have ever seen in my life. A whole section of the city north of the financial district was a solid mass of flames, leaping hundreds of feet in the air. It was a cloudless night, but the smoke covered half of the sky and was all red from the fires below. Now and then, bombs tumbled into structures that were already on fire and raised regular geysers of flame. Among the people around him, he saw only an interested calm, which astonished him. "They acted," he wrote, "as if the bombing were like a thunderstorm." Nearby at Claridge's Hotel, General Lee, the American military attaché, now back in London, went down to the first floor room of a member of the U.S. Embassy's diplomatic staff, Herschel Johnson. As bombs fell and fires burned, they discussed literature, mainly the works of Thomas Wolfe and Victor Hugo's novel, Les Misérables. The conversation shifted to Chinese art. Herschel brought out a collection of fine porcelain objects. "All this time," Lee wrote, "I had the sickening feeling that hundreds of people were being murdered in a most savage way, almost within a stone's throw, and there was nothing to do about it." 9 blocks away, at the Dorchester, Harriman and other guests from the Fred Astaire dinner watched the raid from the hotel's 8th floor. Among them was Pamela Churchill, who had turned 21 a month earlier. As she walked down a corridor toward the dinner party, she reflected on her new sense of freedom and her new confidence. Later, she recalled thinking, "You know, I am really on my own, and my life is going to change totally now." She had met Harriman before, at Checkers, and now found herself seated beside him. They talked at length, mostly about Max Beaverbrook. Harriman saw Beaverbrook as the man, after Churchill, whom he most needed to befriend. Pamela tried to convey a sense of Beaverbrook's character. At some point, Harriman said to her, "Well, would you know, why won't you come back to my apartment and we can talk easier and you can tell me more about these people?" They went down to his apartment. She was in the midst of providing various insights into Beaverbrook when the raid began. Flares lit the city outside so brightly that Harriman, in a later letter to his wife, Marie, described it as looking like Broadway and 42nd Street. Bombs fell. Clothes were shed. As a friend later told Pamela's biographer, Sally Bedell Smith, "A big bombing raid is a very good way to get into bed with somebody." The raid took a great toll in lives and landscape. It killed 1,180 people and injured far more, making it the worst attack thus far. Bombs struck Piccadilly, Chelsea, Pall Mall, Oxford Street, Lambeth and Whitehall. An explosion tore a great gash into the Admiralty Building. Fire destroyed Christie's Auction House. At St. Peter's Church in Eaton Square, a bomb obliterated the vicar, Austin Thompson, as he stood on the church steps beckoning people to come inside for safety. The next morning, Thursday, April 17th, after having breakfast at 10 Downing Street, John Colville and Eric Seal took a walk onto the Horse Guards Parade to examine the damage. "London looks bleary-eyed and disfigured," Colville wrote in his diary that day. He noted as well that he found Pamela Churchill and Averill Harriman also examining the devastation. He made no further comment. Harriman wrote to his wife about the raid. "Needless to say, my sleep was intermittent. Guns were going all the time, and airplanes overhead." Chapter 87. The White Cliffs. At a cabinet meeting at 11:30 that Thursday morning, Churchill, who had worked through much of the night's raid, noted, accurately, that the damage to the Admiralty Building had improved his view of Nelson's column in Trafalgar Square. It perturbed him, however, that once again the bombers had come with virtually no interference from the RAF. Darkness remained the Luftwaffe's best defence. Perhaps by way of offering encouraging news, the Prof that day sent Churchill a report on the latest tests of his anti-aircraft mines, these involving a variant in which the mines, tiny micro-bombs, were attached to small parachutes and then dropped from planes. The RAF egg-layers had made 21 sorties, during which they managed to set out 6 curtains of mines. These, the Prof claimed, had destroyed at least 1 German bomber, but perhaps as many as 5. In this, the Prof was engaging in an uncharacteristic behaviour, wishful thinking. The only evidence that the bombers had been destroyed was the disappearance of their radar echoes. The action had taken place over the sea. No witnesses provided visual confirmations. No wreckage was found. It was clearly not feasible to get the evidence we might have demanded over land, he acknowledged. He saw none of this, however, a sufficient cause to stop him from claiming all 5 German bombers as successful kills. On Thursday, April 24th, Mary raced home to Checkers from her volunteer work in Aylesbury and had tea with a friend, Fiona Forbes. She and Fiona then rushed off, with piles of luggage, to catch an evening train to London. Mary looked forward to a relaxing bath at the Annex before dressing for the night's fun, but telegrams and telephone calls from friends intervened. She stopped in to talk with Papa. At 7:40 she at last got her bath, though it was less leisurely than she had hoped. She and Fiona were due to attend a party set to begin at 8:15, but planned first to have dinner at the Dorchester with Eric Duncannon and other friends, as well as Mary's sister Sarah and her husband Vic. She was quite taken with her date. In her diary she wrote, "Oh, tais-toi, mon cœur. Be quiet, my heart." They moved on to the party at a club and danced until the band stopped playing at 4 a.m. Mary and Fiona returned to the annex by dawn, with Mary recounting to her diary, "It really was a completely perfect party." She spent the next day, Saturday, at a friend's country home in Dorset, recuperating in leisurely fashion in bed. Very long, delicious lie. And reading a long poem by Alice Duer Miller, The White Cliffs, about an American woman who falls in love with an Englishman, only to have him die in France in the Great War. In the poem, aptly enough, the woman chronicles her love affair and rails against America for failing to immediately join the war. The poem ends, "I am American bred. I have seen much to hate here, much to forgive. But in a world where England is finished and dead, I do not wish to live." Mary wept. In London that Friday, John Colville had his medical interview with the RAF. He underwent more than 2 hours of medical testing and passed every category except eyesight, for which he was rated as being borderline. He was told, however, that he might yet be able to fly, if he got fitted for contact lenses. He would have to pay for that himself, and even then there was no guarantee that he would succeed. But staying at 10 Downing Street no longer seemed appropriate. The more he thought about joining the RAF, the more dissatisfied he felt, and the more he needed to get away. He pursued it now the way he pursued Gay Margesson, with a futile mix of longing and despair. "For the first time since war broke out, I feel discontented and unsettled, bored by most people I meet and destitute of ideas," he told his diary. "I certainly need a change and think an active, practical life in the RAF is the real solution. I am not anxious to immolate myself on the altar of Mars, but have reached the stage of thinking that nothing matters."